My name is Mike Fitzpatrick, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Mike.
My sobriety date is April 23rd, 1985, and for that I'm grateful. Every time I stand up behind one of these things, I'm waiting for someone in the back row to yell, "Stand up!" You know, earlier today, somebody asked me if I was nervous when I get up in front of people and speak, and I want you to know that I'm not nervous because I've got a pretty good idea what I'm going to say. And you have no idea what you're going to hear. So if anyone should be nervous, it should be you and not me. I want to thank the committee for inviting me and Kevin for helping me to have a great afternoon. If you're ever in need of an event, you want to take a ride with this guy. Well, he's trying to get directions. I developed a new relationship with my higher power. As I said, I've got a good idea what I'm going to say, but I feel like a mosquito in a nudist camp. I know what to do, I just don't know where to start. Now, Chris did a great job, too. Thank you. It was wonderful. When I was 6 years old, I burnt the house down. And now, that wasn't really a huge event, you know, to burn the house down. But I was sitting across the street with my family. I grew up with seven kids in my family. So I was one of seven. And I'm sitting across the street on the neighbor's porch watching the firemen run in with the hoses and all the panic in the neighborhood and everything going on. And what's going on in my head is, there is no way I can tell anyone I did this. That is not going to happen. And I kept that secret for a long time. And that secret kept me awake at night. That secret that I couldn't let anyone know. And then other things started to happen after that, and I knew I had to keep those a secret too. So I wouldn't share them with people. I kept them as a secret. And I started having feelings, you know, about stuff I shouldn't be thinking about. You know, my dad was an alcoholic, and he was getting sober when I was really young. And my mom was in Al-Anon. She's just got about 45 years now in Al-Anon. She's out visiting us in Arizona. I tried to bring some sunshine with me today. It was a beautiful day here, too. But tonight, I kind of have some mixed emotions. 13 years ago today, my dad passed away. I share that now because I just wanted to get it out of, done with for the night. Because if I go there later, I may not be able to get myself back together. Because he was very, very instrumental in my sobriety, and you'll hear about that in a few minutes, I hope. But around this time, he was trying to get sober. There were some fights in the house. Things like this were going on, and I'd be laying up in the bedroom, you know, thinking that I was the cause of it. See, at a very early age, I realized it was all about me. At least that's what I thought. And when people were having trouble, I thought it was me. I thought that I would get caught. I was feeling guilty about the things that I did. And I continued to do these things. And I think I was being raised in a good home, little town outside of Buffalo, New York. And I think my parents were doing a wonderful job with what they had, with the finances that they had, with the amount of children they had. You know, I kid around and I say we had seven kids. I shared a bedroom with two of my brothers. I didn't sleep alone until I was married. Yeah. That's not true. My brother's first communion, he's my older brother. John was, I think, second grade. That would have made me in first grade. And I had my first drink of alcohol that I remember at his first communion because we stole some beer out of the cooler and we snuck it around the side of the house and we each drank a beer. And without John knowing, I went back to the cooler, took some more, hid it in the woods so I could have it the next day. Now, I don't know why I did that. Right? I mean, it wasn't like I drank the booze and all my problems went away. What is that? I was just thinking it was my alarm going off here, you know. But from the very first time I drank, I was planning when I could do it again. And that was how my drinking was. Now, by the time I was, well, I guess I'll share a little bit of a drunkalogue. Okay? Well, no, I won't. My first detox was in Children's Hospital. Okay? I was being detoxed for barbiturate and alcohol addiction. And I'm in the hospital, and they've got me in this room. They didn't call it intensive care, but it was right across from the nurse's station so they could watch me. And I think the kid that was in the room with me actually died because they took him out. You know, he had all kinds of tubes and things. I'm in there, and they're watching me come off of the chemicals that I was on and the alcohol. And during that time, they came to me and they said, this is my dad and some of his friends in AA. They came to me and said, you know, we'd like you to come to AA when you get out of here. And I said, okay, you know, I'll do that. And my parents also suggested that I would start going to counseling. It was kind of the condition I was being released from the hospital on. So I agreed to do that. And 6 weeks after my first counseling session, I was smoking weed with a counselor. It was a new therapy. My parents wondered why I always wanted to get there early. Can we go to counseling now? Isn't it time yet? It didn't work. I remember my first AA meeting. It was on a Friday night. It's a hillbilly group in Orchard Park, New York, and it was in the bottom of a police station. I was 15 years old, and I walked down there, and it was old wooden tables, a low ceiling, a smoke-filled room. There's a bunch of men around, a couple of women. They're going around the room like we do at all the meetings, and Bob, I'm an alcoholic. Ernie, I'm an alcoholic. Dorothy, I'm an alcoholic. Pete, I'm an alcoholic. Art, I'm an alcoholic. And it comes to me, and I said, I'm Mike, and I'm a problem drinker with alcoholic tendencies. Because I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I had absolutely no interest in being an alcoholic. If there's one thing I knew I didn't want to be, it was an alcoholic. They said, keep coming back, and I did. And they said some weird things to me, like, it's the first drink that gets you drunk. And I'm thinking, you didn't drink with me. Yeah. If you waddle like a duck and quack like a duck, you're probably a duck. I'd like go home and I'd look in the mirror. Yeah. What are they talking about? But I kept coming back and they didn't throw me out. They let me come back and they kept saying, keep coming back. And I'd come in and I'd see you and you'd get some recognition for staying sober for 30 days. I couldn't do that. I'd get drunk. And I'd think this was working for you because every time I stopped drinking, see, they'd say, don't drink, go to meetings. That's what I thought I heard. Now, that was probably not everything I was hearing, but that was what I was pulling out of what I was hearing. It was my perception at the time was Alcoholics Anonymous was don't drink and go to meetings. I wouldn't drink and go to a meeting. I'd want to die. And I don't mean like just a little bit want to die. Like I'd want to kill myself. Die. And I couldn't do it. You know, I couldn't stay sober without, I couldn't not drink. I would come to the meetings and I would go drink. And I, every time I did that, I felt like a failure. I felt like I was a disappointment to everyone in my life. I wanted to be a good kid. I wanted to be a good student. I wanted to be good in sports. I wanted to be good in school. I wanted to do the right things. I wanted people to be pleased with my behavior. I couldn't measure up. I couldn't do it. I tried to go to AA and I'd end up drunk again. And then I would feel worse, and somebody would get a 30-day chip, and I'd feel, oh my God, how can they do it and I can't do it? And somebody would get a year. And it's like, that's crazy. How can you stop drinking for a year? And someone would get married, and I'd be jealous at them. And just whenever something good happened, that was bad for me. Because I would see magnified why I couldn't do this deal, and you guys could. I knew that it worked for you. I saw it happen in my home. I saw families restored. I saw the picnics, and I got to participate in these things as a kid. And my parents, the New York State Police, would occasionally drop a drunk off on our front porch, and my mom would make meals, and my dad and his sponsor would take them to meetings. And I'd come home from school, and there'd be a drunk at the table, you know, sitting there shaking with a cup of coffee, waiting for dinner, and we'd eat the donuts after the meetings, and, you know, on and on. There was recovery and sobriety and all of this stuff in my house, but I couldn't see it because I felt like I was different. There was something wrong with me deep inside. There was something very sick inside of me, and I wasn't sure what it was. But when I drank alcohol, I could tolerate it. See, I didn't go out and do the things that I did because I always wanted to. I think that I had a desire to stop drinking. I think I came to Alcoholics Anonymous over and over and over for years, wanting to not drink. That behavior went on for 10 years. I came to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in and out for 10 years, never getting 30 days sober. People would look at me, oh, here he comes again. I'd go in, they'd think I'm there to put the bite on him or to touch or look for a job or some money or whatever. They told me the things that would happen when I first started to come to AA. Those nice people in AA told me exactly what would happen because they began to share with me their experiences. And they said, these are the things that happen if we don't stop. And then during that 10-year period of time, most of those things happened. I got to visit a psychiatric ward. Yeah, I remember that. I remember that the girl that was doing the intake, I thought she was attractive, and I thought that I was probably the right guy for her. So I'm trying to explain this to her while she's doing the intake paperwork for me to be in a psychiatric ward. Okay? And I'm wondering why she won't give me her phone number. Okay? You know, they say some of us are sicker than others, you know. But that didn't stop me from drinking. It only slowed me down long enough to convince another doctor that this time I was going to make it happen. I was going to go to AA and bless myself, and it was going to be better. And they let me out. And that was the story of my life. They didn't put me in the hospitals all the time for alcoholism, you know, it's for gastritis or kidney stones or pneumonia or whatever, because I was a kid and they didn't want all this stuff on my charts, you know. But it was alcoholism every single time. And every single time I had to convince someone that it was going to be different when I got out. That I was going to get involved in AA and I was going to be better. But I never believed it. Because I tried. I knew I was a failure. You know, I graduated high school. That was a big event for me. I try to explain that to my kids today. Graduating high school was huge because I never went. And when I did, I was intoxicated. I had lots of nicknames in high school. One of them, well, the day I graduated, here's the picture. You got my mom and my dad and my grandmother in the auditorium. This is a big event, okay? You've got a couple of other family members. I, on the way to the graduation, stop and do a few shots of Wild Turkey so I could get through it. They call my name, and I'm walking across the stage, and one of the kids in the back of the room yells as loud as he can one of my nicknames, which happened to be Drugs. I don't know where it came from. But before I got that diploma, I knew I was a disappointment. Here it was, the biggest event that had occurred in my life to that time. And one more time, I'm a disappointment. These events went on and on. On April 23rd, 1985, I broke into a house in Buffalo, New York. And I broke into the house for one reason. I knew the guy that lived there had a gun. I had finally gotten the courage to commit suicide. And I broke into the house that night, and I looked all over, and I never found the gun. And it was beginning to get daylight, and I'm looking out the window at the attic. This is like three stories high, and I'm looking out the window, and I'm trying to calculate, if I dive through that window, head first, or feet first, is the fall going to kill me? Or am I going to flop around on the sidewalk in pain? and I didn't want any more pain. And while I'm looking out that window, I see a couple of ladies coming down the street wearing these funny church hats. And it reminded me of my grandmother when I was a kid growing up, coming over to the house with her friends after church on Sunday. And for the first time in many years, I got down on my knees in that room that day by myself. And I said the alcoholic prayer. And that was just simply, God help me. I didn't know what else to do. And I didn't get a great breath of air like Bill W. did in the hospital or feel like I was on a mountaintop. But I can tell you that God began to do some things in the invisible that later I was able to see. Because things began to line up. And later that day, I got the courage to call the only person left in my life that I knew would be willing to help me. That was my dad. He asked where I was, and I told him they hadn't seen me for a while. I would disappear. And they hadn't seen me for a while, and I told him where I was, and I agreed to meet him and another guy the next day. So they met me, and we discussed my options. I didn't have any. And I ended up coming off the booze that time. They tried to get me into a hospital, and I'll keep that story short because it could take... That's one of the things. It's like the older I get, the longer my stories are. Why is that? My kids are like, you already told us that, Dad. Anyway, now I hear my mother do it, and it's like, you told me that story 10 minutes ago. So, at least I wait a few weeks. Anyway, I walk in this hospital and the admissions counselor walks out of his office into the lobby of the medical center there, and he puts his hands up and he looks at me and he says, you can stop right there because you're not coming in here. You've been here too many times. And I walked out of there with a feeling of hopelessness unlike any hopelessness I had ever felt. And I was angry. And I had a little resentment toward that guy. Because my dad sponsored him for a while. So I thought that was the wrong way to treat me. Didn't he know who I was? So I walked to the taxi cab in front of the hospital and said, take me to a bar, because where else do you go when you got nothing left to do? I was done. I was finished. I can't even get well. I knew AA wouldn't work. I knew NA wouldn't work. I knew counseling didn't work, or the church. I tried all that. Nothing worked for me, so I had to go back to the only place I knew, and that was the bar, and he took me there. And I ordered a drink. And I sat there and I started drinking the drink, and it was a beautiful afternoon. It was April 23rd, the door was open. You could see the sunshine coming down, and a city bus pulled up. And a lady was trying to get on that bus, and she fell down. And I walked out of that bar. I helped that lady get on the bus. And I followed her on. And I never went back for the drink. It's probably warm by now. Now, 3 days before that, I would have taken that lady's purse and ran. I can't tell you tonight why. I followed her on that bus. But that was the last drink of alcohol I ever ordered or ever drank. And I'm grateful tonight for that. Now, I know that later when Bill, if I get to talk a little bit about history tonight, and I don't know, a lot of times I do that, but, Abby went to Bill. And he talked to him, and Bill found out that giving of ourselves to others is where the magic's at. Okay? It's by giving ourselves to others, by giving ourselves without expectation of return. And that was beat into my head later. But maybe that was the first time in my life I got out of myself and tried to give to someone else who couldn't give back to me. Just in that simple gesture, helping that woman get on the bus. A short time after that, my dad, they didn't really know what to do with me. So my dad called a friend of his named Big John. And John was down in Brownwood, Texas. And Dick over here doing the taping knew John. John probably spoke, well, I don't know if he would have spoke here, but he spoke a lot up in Kansas. But anyway, he sent me down to see Big John. John got sober in 1951. So they stuck me on an airplane, sent me down to Brownwood. I flew into Abilene, Texas. I'm greeted at the airport by Big John and two other sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. They pick me up and they take me to an AA meeting. On the way there, John suggested to me that I might not want to say anything other than maybe give my sobriety date, if I had one. So I made one up, because I didn't know what it was. So we went to the meeting. The meeting was just like any other meeting. Well, anyway, I'm going to lighten it up here for a minute. In Texas, they give their sobriety date, okay? Now, they have different ways of doing it. Some people, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink at this time, or my sobriety is this, or my dry date is that. And there was one guy one day, he says, my name is Ed, and I haven't had a drink for four... I haven't found it necessary to take a drink for 14 years, 6 months, 6 weeks, 3 days, and 9 hours. And a guy up front turns around and says, Ed, that's a lie. I saw you drunk Saturday night. You were so drunk you couldn't even get down the street. He said, yeah, but it wasn't necessary. I want you to know that every drink I had was necessary to get me to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That night after that meeting, we went back to John's little one-bedroom apartment in Bangs, Texas. Okay? Now, Bangs, Texas, this is like the late-night crowds. I can do this, okay? Bangs, Texas. Well, if anybody here from Bangs, I want to apologize, okay? But I think Bangs, Texas had about 300 people and about 600 sheep, okay? I used to say nervous sheep, but I took it out of my talk. In any case, he takes me to Bangs, Texas. And we're sitting in his house that night. Now, John was a big guy with silver hair, always smoked a cigar, always wore a suit jacket. He was a former attorney, and he seemed to be pacing that night. And he said, how long you been around the deal, kid? And with as much ego as you can have, when you weigh 90 pounds and you're wearing somebody else's pants, I said, well, about 10 years. He said, well, I don't know if you've got the guts it takes to make it. But if you do, we can show you by living proof how you never have to live that way again. If you want to get sober, I'll go to hell and back with you. And if you don't, you can go to hell alone. I'm waiting for Welcome to Texas. He said, you are nothing but a thief. Maybe not the kind of thief that'd steal money from your mother's purse or kick in a joint. He said, you are a worse kind of thief than that because you stole from those you love the most their right to happiness. For the first time in 10 years, I didn't have a comeback. For the first time, he had faced me with the truth about myself. All those times, I would say, hey, the only one around here with a problem is you. If you get off my back, I'll manage better next time. It's going to be all right. Help me get a job. Give me a place to live. Give me a few dollars. Help me out. It's going to be all right. I'll handle it. And John laid the truth out. I began to listen. He got my attention. And I think that's the power of one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic, is he got my attention. Okay? That the teacher will appear when the student is ready. And, you know, I was ready. I don't know how all that stuff happens and gets all lined up, but I certainly know, okay, that John had the ability to be very effective with me. The next day, he said, come on, kid, he got me up early in the morning. Too. I mean, it was early. Come on, we got places to go. He's 80 years old. Where do we got to go? You know, I weigh 90 pounds. Everything I own is in a cardboard box. There's nobody looking for me for anything right now, okay? Come on, kid, we got people to see, places to go. And he takes me to his best friend's house in Brownwood, Texas. And this guy's name was Bill O. And Bill had the Midwest Tape Library, and at the time it was the largest AA tape library in the world. Okay? At least that's what John told me, and I believe him. We walked into this tape library, and I'm telling you, it's like walls of reel-to-reel tapes everywhere you look, okay? And he introduces me to Bill. Now, Bill had one arm and one eye, okay? And I immediately nicknamed Bill Grumpy, okay? But it was in my head. I didn't tell him that. I just kept that one a secret, okay? But he was grumpy. Well, these guys start talking, and they're having a conversation. And we're sitting there drinking instant coffee. Boy, it was tough getting sober back then. But anyway, we're drinking the instant coffee, and I'm not complaining. I'm listening to these guys talk, and I thought it was my turn. Well, let me share this with you, too. At that time, I could get a 7-word sentence out, and 3 of them started with F, okay? And I thought it was my turn, so I volunteered one of my sentences. And Bill starts pounding his finger down on the table, and he says, "Young man, the first thing we clean up in here is our mouth." And I'm thinking, grumpy. So we leave. I said to John, I said, "What's up with Grumpy?" I said, "He's going to try. I'm 25 years old. He's going to tell me how to talk? You guys got to be kidding me." He said, "Listen, kid. What Bill wanted to tell you is that, you know, he and I, Bill got sober." This is kind of funny. Bill got sober October 21st of 1951. John got sober October 28th of 1951. So Bill had 1 week on John. He never let him forget it. These guys knew Ebby. They knew Bill W. and Lois. They knew a lot of the guys that were the pioneers that helped to make AA happen in the early days. And they had deep respect for the men and women that had walked the path before them. And John said, "Bill wants you to have respect for the program that saved our lives. It may save yours. You may be the only big book that some new person, new guy or woman get to see. And he wants you to be accurate. And he wants you to be a good example of what Alcoholics Anonymous is. That's why he said that to you, kid. And from that day to this, I've never found it necessary to use foul language in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I try not to do it in my home. But I don't do it at meetings. And I appreciate it when you don't do it at meetings either. Not that I won't get preachy or start giving you my opinions, okay? Because then we'll really be here for a while. My sponsor is a guy named Howard P. Some of you know Howard and Pat. Howard's in Gilbert, Arizona. He did tell me to tell everyone hello. All of his friends. Great guy. We got a home group. My home group is We Ain't Dead Yet. We meet on Mondays and Wednesdays. And if you're in Gilbert, Arizona, we'd love to have you come and be our guest. My flight was not nearly as eventful as Chris's. I just got on the airplane, meditated for 2.5 hours, got off and went and had barbecue. It was my kind of flight. So every day, getting sober, here I am with this 80-year-old guy. Okay? Now I'm thinking, what am I going to do? What am I going to do with all my time? And I tell him, "John, what am I going to do? I got all this time." He'd say, "Walk the dog, kid." And I'd go walk the dog. Come back. "What am I going to do? Walk the dog, kid." He'd take me swimming every day. We'd go out to Brownwood Lake and go swimming. He'd take me over to Bill O's house in the morning. We'd visit Bill, and then we'd go see a old lady friend of his that he'd call on just to make sure that she had some food and she was all right. She was an elderly woman. He was 80. I think she was about 90 at the time. Then we'd go to meetings at night, and then we'd go to the coffee shop after the meeting. And then we'd go from the coffee shop to his house, and maybe somebody'd come there, and we'd sit in his house, and we'd read, you know, the big book or the 12 and 12 or listen to a tape. And I did want to mention that, you know, invest in the CDs. You know, They're the greatest thing in the world for the newcomers. Give them tapes and CDs to listen to. That tape library that Bill and Arvutis had, I have in my home today. And my wife and I have been working to get it digitized so that we can make it available to the next generation of AA and Al-Anon members. So that's a little service project that we've undertaken. It's huge. There's 3,500 reel-to-reel recordings we're having digitized. So it's been an enormous project, undertaking. But we would, every day, we would do this. And we would sit, and finally I said to him one day, why do we do this? He said, kid, you need proper rest, proper diet. Well, he said, talk to some dietitians, though. Proper exercise and the best therapy in the world, and that's plenty of AA meetings. And that's what we did, and I started to get a little bit better each day. Just a little bit better each day. See, when I first got there, I would eat and I'd go in the bathroom and I'd get sick. Because I couldn't eat and I couldn't keep it down. But each day, it got a little better. Started to put on a few pounds. I started to look good. They gave me assignments when I went to meetings. They told me things like stand at the door and greet people and tell them you're glad to see them. And I'd say, why? Because we told you to. Okay. So I did. Then I got to wash ashtrays, and you know, then I got to chair a meeting, got to give a 5-minute pitch, and you know, I began to do the things that they were suggesting to me to do. And it was so critically important for me to have good sponsorship. John traveled a lot, and he was gone on one of his trips, and he came back, and I said, I did it, and he said, what? And I said, I read it, and he said, what? And I said, the big book. It was really only the 164 pages that I read, but I said, the big book, and he said, I read Moby Dick, kid, and I don't remember a damn bit of it. So we got to study that book. So what do you think we're doing the next day? We're sitting in his den studying the big book, and I'm asking questions, and we're underlining things that make sense to me. And when he would travel, he'd bring me along with him, and he'd be reading to me. It was like AA school on wheels. I had Bill with the tapes, and these guys talking about the history, and Sam Shoemaker and the Oxford Group and the early AAs and the struggles with the big book and all the things that happened through Alcoholics Anonymous. And here John's teaching me as we're driving. I'm the designated driver. And then he'd quiz me. What's Dr. Bob's address, kid? 855 Ardmore Avenue. It was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. One day I'm sitting in that library, and they introduced me to a guy, his name is Bob Smith, and his father was one of the co-founders of AA, Smitty. And we're sitting there talking, and Smitty says to me, did Bill or John tell you about the first guy that my dad and Bill Wilson worked with? And I'm like, oh yeah, Bill D., Akron City Hospital, AA number 3, and I start giving the whole AA story. And he says, no, Mike, he said, there was a guy before Bill D., there was a guy named Eddie. And he said, Eddie was a bad drunk. And he said, they put Eddie upstairs in the bedroom, and Eddie'd climb out and go down the drain pipe, and he'd go get drunk, and Dr. Bob and Bill would go round Eddie up, and they'd bring him back and try to sober him up. And Eddie was a crazy drunk, and Eddie one day was chasing Ann Smith around the house with a butcher knife. And they had to have Eddie committed. So he said the first guy my dad and Bill W. tried to work with was a failure. He had to be committed. They couldn't help him. He said, but the story didn't stop there, Mike. 15 years later at my dad's funeral, a guy came up to me and said, do you know who I am? And he looked and he said, why, you're Eddie. And Eddie shook his hand, and Eddie had been sober for 2 years. The seed was planted. I don't care what your problem is, but if you are an alcoholic and you have come into these meetings like I did and come in and come out and come in and come out, please come back and stay. I thought I was a failure. I thought Alcoholics Anonymous didn't work for me. And when Smitty told me the story of Eddie, I knew for the first time I was home in Alcoholics Anonymous, because this deal wasn't built on success. It was built on failure. Thank God for that story. And I appreciate the work that Bill and Dr. Bob did, because they didn't stop it, Eddie. They went on and they found someone who was ready, and AA started, and the miracle began to grow and continues to grow today. Continues. I believe Alcoholics Anonymous today is better than it's ever been in its almost 75-year history. I believe sponsorship's better today than it's ever been. I'm not one of these people who want to go back to some magical time when AA used to get some kind of conversion that never happened anyway. Okay? AA works just fine today. One alcoholic working with another alcoholic. Sometimes we have to carry that person and lift them up. That's what they did for me. They never once said, "You take the cotton out of your ears and stick it in your mouth." Never. Tell you what they did. They lifted me up. John said to me, "Kid, would you make me breakfast?" And he said, "Make me some eggs and put a little yolk on them, you know." And so I did, man. I didn't know how to cook, but you know, I just figured you got sausage grease, and if it's hot enough, you throw some eggs in there, this is going to be okay. So I did, and he ate them, and he'd go around for the rest of the day bragging about the kid. He said, "Oh man, the kid made me breakfast today. He is the greatest cook. This kid really." And then I started to feel good. See, he started to find the things that I could do, and he started to let me do that, and then he praised me about it and lifted me up. And then I wanted to do more. See, when I came to you, I was empty. See, when I came to you, I had no self-confidence, no self-image. I hated myself. That was the only feeling I had. And I came in here, and you guys lifted me up. I remember there was a guy at our home group, his name was AJ, and AJ had a golden tan and white hair, and AJ had the biggest smile you ever seen. He always had that smile plastered all over his face. And I remember one day I said, "AJ, how are you?" And he says, "I'm doing fine." And I swear I thought he was on pills. And I said, "You really mean that, AJ?" And he says, "I sure do. And it just keeps getting better." I left that meeting that night and I thought, I want to be more like AJ. I want to start to act more like AJ. When people said, "How you doing, Mike?" I started saying, "I'm doing good and it's getting better. I'm doing good and it's getting better. I'm getting better. This is starting to make sense to me. I got my 30-day chip. I got my 60-day chip. I got my 6-month maybe. I got a year. They had a damn parade. It was amazing. Let me tell you something, man. When I got a year, now John had a 1-bedroom apartment. Okay? Can you tell I had too much coffee today? I'm like, "Pow!" Anyway. My year, I'm going to try to do this without crying, okay? But I got my 1 year. Man, I woke up, I'm in a 1-bedroom apartment. Here's an 80-year-old guy, okay? I woke up out of the bed. I walked out of the bedroom. He had camped on the couch. See? I went to visit for 2 weeks. I stayed for 2 years. On my first birthday, before I was out of bed, he is on the phone talking to my parents about the kid getting a year. He's bragging on me. I can hear this. I walk out. You think I'm not lifted up? That's what we need to do for the newcomers. Make them want to come. I wanted to be around you people then. Then he says to me, "Hey kid, Bill wants you to drive for him." Bill would go tape at all these places, you know. And he said, "Bill, why, he's not feeling too good. He wants you to drive him to Casper, Wyoming." And I said, "Okay." And then we left, you know, we left Bill's library that day, and we headed back to Brownwood. And John said, "Kid, Bill never let anyone drive for him. He does it by himself always. You're the first one that he's ever asked. Now you think I'm feeling good. Now I'm thinking even Bill recognizes what they have in me." Okay? I mean, we're talking potential here. It wasn't until about 5 years ago his daughter said, "Oh, heck, he had people drive him all that." I'm like, "Shut up! Don't tell me that, man. You're ruining my story." I told you, Bill had one arm and one eye. We're driving through Denver. It's snowing. And I'm, you know, in Denver, it snows like Cleveland. And I mean, it snows. It's snowing. He's driving. He's from Texas. They don't believe in speed limits in Texas. Okay? He's a pipe smoker. Okay? He's lighting his pipe. He's doing 80. He's looking at me. Now I'm having a new relationship with my higher power. Yeah, I'm grateful to the men and the women that were there, that took the time to explain this to me. You know, I'm starting to read that big book, and I read in the big book that it says that it's a great obsession of every abnormal drinker that somehow, some way, is going to control and enjoy his drinking, that the persistence of this illusion is astonishing, and many pursue it to the gates of insanity or death. Now, I don't know if that's what I was doing, okay? But man, when I got off that airplane, weighing 90 pounds, wearing somebody else's pants, carrying a cardboard box. Wow. You know, maybe when I read that on page 30 of the big book, I started to feel like maybe it was talking to me. I read another thing in there. It said, lack of power is our dilemma. See, I thought drinking was my problem. It said, lack of power is our dilemma. And then it follows it up and says, the main object of this book is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself that will solve your problem. Well, I had to start to find what these problems were that needed to be solved, because obviously drinking was not my problem. If drinking was my problem, I quit drinking, my problem solved. My problem was living. My problem was living without drinking. My problem was living and learning to like myself. My problem was living and learning to like you. My problem was learning how to have a relationship with another human being, because I had never successfully done that. Okay? I can tell you about my whole experience in dating as far as relationships go in one word. I don't have to do a fifth step. You can use your imagination. The word is pathetic. Okay? I stayed with John for 2 years. Okay? I left him and I went to Chandler, Arizona. And I was staying with an AA guy there and going to a lot of meetings and sponsoring people. Oh, that was another thing. First time I got to sponsor someone. Guy asked me to sponsor him. I didn't know what to do. I went and called John. This guy asked me to sponsor him. He's like, well, kid, sponsor him. I'm like, I'll kill him. He's like, just do with him what I did with you. That's simple. So you just take the big book out and start at the beginning. I could do that and take them to a meeting. I could do that. And I began to do that. And today I get to sponsor people. And it's a trip. And I love it. And there's good things that go with that. And there's bad things that go. And somebody asked me not long ago, how many guys do you sponsor, Mike? I said, about half of them. You ever have one of those moments where it's like your brain just kind of, oh, that was Chandler. I'm in Chandler. I'm working with this guy. I'm doing construction work. Okay? See, I was like really unemployable when I came here. Okay, now, at 9 months, I said to John, can I get a job? He's like, no. It's the last thing you need, kid, is a job. You get a job, that means you're going to get a check. You don't need a check, because then I'll see you drunk walking down the street. And they go, okay, this guy must know more than me. I am so grateful that he had the wisdom to be able to share with me the things that I needed to hear. Not the things I wanted to hear, but the things I needed to hear that saved my life and taught me how to live. Taught me how to bring the principles of this program into my life so that I could begin to exercise those principles on a daily basis, one day at a time. They taught me how to do that. And they loved me in the whole process. Well, here I am in Chandler. I got a day off from my construction work, so I go to the pool. It's August. It's hot in Arizona in August. So I'm out at the pool, and this girl dives in the water. So I dive in after her. I introduce myself. She introduces herself. She tells me a little bit about herself, and I tell her a little bit about AA, because it's all I know. Okay? I mean, I'm like, it's sober, and I'm in. I probably gave her, you know, 60 minutes of the last tape I listened to. Who knows, okay? Well, we talked about AA, and I asked her out on a date, and she said no. And I didn't have to go slip my wrist. See? I didn't have to go cry. I didn't have to call my sponsor or get mad at God. I just went to a meeting and worked with my sponsees. That was it. And I saw her a couple days later at the pool, and she said, "My plans changed, and my dad has some baseball tickets, and if you'd like to go, I'd like you to be my guest." And baseball was played outside in Arizona then, and this was August. And I said, I would love to do that. I said, if you'll go on a date with me, if you'll go have dinner with me, and she agreed. So I picked her up in my black Ford Fairmont with no air conditioning in August. And we went and had Chinese food. And she got her fortune cookie, and she read the fortune cookie, and it said something like, "You can trust the man you're with. His love is true." 4 months later, we were married. I've been married for 22 years. I have three... Thank you. I want you to know something. I don't know any more about making marriage work today than I did the day I got married. All I know is if you bring the principles and the traditions of this program into your life, it'll work. You just find a way to do it. You'll go through the good times, you'll go through the bad times, but you'll go through them together. You'll find ways to make things work. My wife is not an AA. She completely supports me and in the program and everything I do. She's answered the phone at 3 o'clock in the morning and can't understand who it is and said, "Oh, it's for you." You know. She's fed the meals to the sponsees and their kids and hugged the wives that needed to be hugged and fed the kids that needed to be fed. She's done the things that we need to do when we're in service to other people. And that, you know, what a gift I've been given in that relationship. What a gift I've been given in the relationship to be able to have a kid. See, long before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I stopped dreaming. See, when I say I was empty, I think the emptiness was there were no dreams left. There was no dreams left worth dreaming because I was just a shell. And I began little by little to have some dreams. And we had our children, and we have three just remarkable kids. And if I talk about my kids emotionally, there's no way that I'll stand here and not have half of you people crying, because the love I have for my family today is just so much. And the gifts that they give me over and over, just to see life around me and to watch life grow in the fellowship and what we have. And, you know, I just have a remarkable life today. Not that we don't have problems, we do. You know, the economy the last year has been difficult for many of us. And, you know, one day at a time, we just keep trusting God and knowing it's going to be okay and going forward. And, you know, that philosophy has worked for me. I believe that today. It isn't just words. See, that an alcoholic, we don't just get to be a miracle. We get to see them every day. You know, God reveals to me the things I need to have revealed to me today. If my eyes are open and I'm plugged in and I'm connected. And when I said I spent 2.5 hours on the plane meditating today, I did. I try to do that every day. I don't usually get 2.5 hours in, but boy, when I do, I'm in a good place. I know how to start my day today. I know today when I wake up, if I wake up tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock, we have to take into consideration what time this talk's going to get done. No, but if I wake up and I'm laying in bed and I think about something, maybe a problem, okay? Well, maybe it's not. Maybe let's just call it a concern, okay? If I think about that concern, okay, and I think about it for, let's say, 60 seconds, all right? Go along with me. The concern went from a concern to a problem in 1 minute. Nothing changed other than I thought about it. Now, if I'm foolish enough to continue to think about it, for another, say, 30 seconds, it's a crisis. It went from a concern to a crisis in 90 seconds. Okay, if I continue to dwell on that for, oh, maybe another 15 seconds, I'm paralyzed. Okay? I mean, I'm immobilized. I can't even function. Okay, because that concern went so far beyond what I can do by myself. So I know what to do today when I get up in the morning. I do get down on my knees. You see, when I first started that, it was because I saw my dad do it when I was a kid. But I started to get down on my knees, and the only prayer I could say was, God, help me get through this day without thinking about taking a drink. That was the first prayer that I could say. God, help me get through this day without thinking about taking a drink. And after a period of time, I went through a day and didn't think about taking a drink. It was amazing. But I knew right then that God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. You know, and the promises it says, we'll be amazed before we're halfway through. We're going to come to know a new freedom, a new happiness. These things just began to happen. And I know today if I stay plugged in and do the things that I was taught and continue to try to carry the message, okay, continue to try to live by the responsibility pledge to the best of my ability today. That's all I need to do it for is one day. I can get through this. You know, the things they said way back when I went to that first meeting when I was 15 years old about it's the first drink that gets you drunk, it all makes sense to me today. I understand if I don't pick up one drink of alcohol for one day, I have a chance. I know that today. Okay? I know that there's hope in these rooms. I know that there's people coming to these rooms in way worse situations than I came in, and the miracle happens and their life gets better, and they stand up here and they give beautiful messages of hope and love to others. And I also know there's many that die. See, we're the few lucky ones. We're the ones that are fortunate. I hope a day never goes by that I don't remember my gratitude for the God that saved my life, that directed me, that put these people in my life. I hope that my gratitude goes forward and is extended to the people that come in, that call me, that need a kindness and a helping hand, that need some encouragement and some direction. I hope that I'm always willing to do that one day at a time, regardless of where that means I have to go. Sometimes I don't want to do that, and I don't always live up to 100% of what I think is best. But I do what I can today. And that's what works for me, and I'm grateful for that. And, you know, it says we share what it was like in a general way. You know, what happened, what it was like, and what it's like today. I'd love to just go on and tell you what it's like today, but I have to tell you something. The dreams began to come to life for me. And a couple of years ago, I met a guy. I was speaking in Myrtle Beach at a small little conference there, and I met a guy there who's an author. And this guy has written some books and movies, and he and I hung out and spent a day together, and we thought, you know, it'd be a good idea to write a book together. So about a year ago, he called me up and he said, Mike, do you still want to write that book? And I said, do I want to write the book? I'd love to write the book. Now, I've never written a book. Okay? This is a dream. Okay? He said, well, the publisher wants us to write the book, so we're going to write the book. And I said, okay, we're going to write the book. That's great. Now, I'm not going to give a plug for the book, but what I want to tell you I did was I had fear that I couldn't do this. Okay? Because every time I'm faced with something I don't know what to do, fear is the first thing that happens. I don't know why faith isn't the first thing that happens instinctively for me, but it's fear. Then I have to try to find a faith to get rid of the fear. And once I do, the fear goes away. And it works out. Okay? It works out. So the book is done. Now, if you're sitting there tonight and you're saying, I got a dream, I got something I want to do, and you're not taking action on it, start taking action on it. Because if you're doing God's work, the walls will come down and you'll be able to do those things. And I know that. Now, I do have to wrap it up, as much as I don't want to. Two real quick things I want to share with you. A couple of years ago, my mother-in-law came to our house, and she asked, I was working at home, and she asked if we'd consider having her mother come live with us. And she was 97, and she'd be moving from a total care facility into our house, and she was a total care patient. And without really thinking it through, I'm like, sure, bring it on. So they wheeled her in. They got the hospital bed all set up. My wife was teaching at the time. So I was the caregiver. And the first day, you know, they brought in like a nurse's aide to kind of teach me how to take care of her. And they left. And they left her. And I didn't know what to do. And my wife made it very clear that she was not going to be the one that was taking care of Grandma, especially all of the detail stuff. Well, I didn't know what to do. So I went into my room. It was just like when I sponsor a new guy, and I got down on my knees and I said, God, I can't do this. I need you to do this for me. And she stayed with us for a year, and never one time did I ever have a problem taking care of her. That wasn't about me, and the reason I share that is because God works through us in no matter what we do when we're of service to others without expectation of return. And that has been my experience. And I hope today that when I'm doing something for someone else, that I am doing it without an expectation of return. And if I am expecting my return, then I've received my reward. And I know that that's true today. My reward for sobriety, for giving what we give away in AA, is that I get to stay sober. And boy, am I thankful that there were people who taught me that. Dr. Bob, in his last talk, said, if you took Alcoholics Anonymous and you simmered it down to just two things, you'd have love and service. And you know, we know what love is, an unbiased attitude of goodwill toward everyone. That's what John said to me about love. And I said, well, what is that? And he said, well, kid, that just means that you don't wish somebody get hit by a car today. He lowered the bar down so that I could reach it. He didn't make me come up to where he was. He came down to where I was. That's the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. We'll meet you where you are, and we'll lift you up. Because I got drunk, and we get sober. You don't do this alone. This program is simple as ABC, accept, begin, and continue. I could have given my talk with just that. Except begin and continue. My sponsor's first sponsor, John, his sponsor, is a guy named, it doesn't matter what his name is. His name was Dick Breen. And I was blessed. Now, I've been so blessed to listen to the recordings of the people that hammered this deal out and made the traditions what they are. In the first tradition, our common welfare comes first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. I hope everything that I do in my AA life is to keep unity within AA so that new person that comes in tonight or tomorrow feels welcome. Dick closed the talk by saying, a bell is not a bell until we ring it. And a song is not a song until we sing it. And love wasn't put in our hearts to stay. Love is only love when we give it away. I love you guys, and thank you for having me.